Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the podcast that rides out financial storms like a web surfer on a 2.0 bubble. My name is Alex Kratosky and I'm fresh back from New York City, the shiny red apple at the heart of global meltdown. But more on that later. Joining me to debate the highs, lows, bulls and bears of the technological and internet landscape are the pod team, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both.
Hey.
Hola.
Hello. Which technologies have you retreated to in this time of financial turmoil?
Well,
I
was trying to find a replacement for Newsfire, which is my RSS reader that I absolutely love. And I fiddled with Vienna, and I fiddled with Google Reader, and I fiddled with NetNewsWire. And in the end, I came back to Newsfire, because although the developer is notoriously grumpy, it's still the best-looking RSS reader that I have found.
I also like the fact that, like you can with some of the other ones, but it's web-based, and you can still get protected. It's password protected.
No, the Newsfire is the one that sits on your desktop. And actually, I emailed the developer, David Watanabe, and I said, it would be great if I could sync this between my home and work versions. And he said, well, you have to find another reader then, because I'm not going to do that.
Well, that's a stellar review, Charles. which grumpy technologies have you been working with this week?
Actually, I've been trying to help Jemima out to automate some of the process of a delicious, posting delicious links onto the blog.
I sorted it.
But most of what I've been doing, struggling with the blogs. Got to say, the technology and games blogs, you know, we've changed it all, the plumbing at the back, and it's all gone from Imperial to Metric, and blimey, it's complicated.
And PDA también.
PDA as well.
Yeah. Oh, see. Anyway, on this week's podcast, we're heading to the epicenter of the banking crisis with the UK Department of Trade and Industry's digital mission. We brought 21 Webby Brits to America, and we wanted to find out what it takes to set up a web business across the Atlantic. We're also picking apart the cult of Lotus Notes. Charles demands answers from Ed Brill from IBM. These stories and more, plus the latest from you and the blogs, over the next 30 minutes. Hold on to your stocks. It's going to be a bumpy ride. Based on the recent economic issues in New York, September may not have been the best time to bring 21 of the brightest and shiniest Web2 startups to the Big Apple to find out how to make the leap over the proverbial pond. But timing isn't everything, and that's exactly what the UKTI and British social network Chinwag did. The digital mission hit the streets of Manhattan to find out how to make it in the US. And on the plane over, I turned to my seatmate to find out who he was and why he was heading to New York to try his luck at breaking America.
I'd like to welcome you on board this British Airways operated Boeing 767 aircraft for our flight to New York. We're almost ready to go, about to close the passenger doors.
My name is David Jacklin and I come from Little Loud Studios. We're involved in digital entertainment. We've got a range of works going on with the West Coast in the States with the movie studios, but we want to build a relationship with the broadcasters, and the TV networks are all based in New York.
What are your expectations for the next couple of days?
Building an initial relationship with the broadcasters. We're in to talk to NBC and HBO and those types of characters. Looking after loads of broadcasters in the UK now, we want to grow that to the HBOs and the NBCs, plus the more niche firms that are just so New York centric. Then it makes serious sense for us to be doing business there.
In my other day job, I'm the UK Department of Trade and Industry's new media sector champion, and I went with them to New York last week on a digital mission to the Web 2.0 Expo. While there, I met up with Tom Watson, the MP for West Bromwich East, and the cabinet minister with a technological brief, and I asked him why he was involved.
I've got a latent inner geek, and I want to apply that to government policy. The technology is so new and so cutting edge, it's very hard for government as an institution to sort of embrace that kind of change and the disruptiveness of it. And I want to be able to be the digital realm sort of minister within government. I make it my business to try and talk to startups, to establish companies, to try and understand the difficulties that they have in the current economic climate and try and do my best for them. But really, I want to be their voice in Parliament. UKTI have given a great platform. They've used the weight of government to get access into some of the most powerful boardrooms in New York. These guys just wouldn't be able to do that on their own.
What are your expectations from this week?
Well, I want them to come away as with better businesses, with a great, stronger networks, with new ideas, with a renewed vigour. And if they can come away and make a success of their businesses as a result of the government giving them access, then, you know, we've all done a little bit to help the UK economy. And let's face it, it probably needs it.
My name is Aoife Ross and I'm event coordinator on the digital mission. will connect the British companies to companies in New York and VCs, investors, get the name about, get a bit of PR up and running up in New York. I think it'd be good to give companies an idea of what's going on in the States at the moment, market conditions, forecasts for the industry. It'll be a good place for the companies to connect with higher profile companies as well, hopefully to meet a few either partner agencies or VCs as well, and give them the opportunity to take a look at the possibility of setting up shop in New York or America.
My name's Ramsey Khoury, and I'm the founder of Head London. I don't have any expectations because we've not really thought about setting up a business in the States. And I think if we can go out there and tap into some of the resources, knowledge, network, that would be very interesting for us. I think New York's more about stepping into the US, getting contacts, breaking into the US market. You know, it's not just about getting your funding. It's about who are you connected with and how can they help help position you in the right place. You know, I think that's it. Success for me would be, I think, walking away with an increased knowledge of what's going on in the States, how it all works, meeting some people, you know, just having the time out to leave London. I think I'm going to be able to take a step back from my business and just see what we're about and what's going on and put the two together. A good outcome for me would be a new clear focus strategically for Head.
Once settled into New York, the mission began. 5 days of networking, learning sessions, and meetings all planned to give these hot web startups a leg up in the Big Apple. One of the sessions was led by Barry Vitu, a corporate partner at the London office of Winston & Strawn, one of the sponsors of the mission. And afterwards, I asked him what the most important point was for startups when it comes to the red tape.
The US actually is a fairly friendly place to do business. I think that people may have a perception that it's difficult or that there are punitive damages or whatever. But the reality is that with proper counsel and a bit of due diligence while you're bootstrapping your business, there are ways through all of that red tape so that you can get into the market and get going and get selling.
Someone who was here and doing this already was Chrissy Philalethes from Stake, a digital agency based in New York. They set up the company about a year ago, and she discussed with me the problems and issues as she saw them for the missionaries, as well as what the draw of the States was for her.
The opportunity here is large. It is so huge. Being an English-speaking country makes it a lot easier as well. Even though we're in a digital world and we work in cyberspace, it's still about relationships, it's still about people. And so being here and having that presence, that's what gets, you know, your foot in the door. If you're trying to win a piece of US business out of the UK, it's just not going to happen.
Of the things that you decided to do before you moved, before you moved the company out here, what would you say were the most successful decisions that you made?
Gaining really good guidance and counsel from people that had already done this before. We were lucky enough that one of our board members had already expanded into America.
What was the second most important thing, second most important decision that you made?
Investing the time to actually come out here prior to coming out to set up so that we networked with individuals so that we actually started looking and seeing what's the team that we want to create.
After a week's meeting and greeting, we were back in the plane to Heathrow, and on the way back, I caught up with some of my seat neighbors to see how things went for them. The last word goes to David Jacklin again, but before that, Aoife Ross again on what she now saw as the opportunities for Americans interested in British companies.
Americans can use the British market as a springboard into Europe. Obviously, you've got all the Eastern countries, which are developing at a very fast rate, unlike America, where their economies are slowing down slightly. And you've also got a lot of British talent as well. So I think a lot of the American companies have underestimated what's in Britain at the moment and how fast the technology is evolving and how skilled the workers are over here.
What do you think are the stumbling blocks based upon some of the information that we gleaned when we were over in the States?
It's hard to change people's perceptions. So with the economy, you know, being in an unhealthy state, shall we say, at the moment, American companies are looking very much inwardly, so they don't want to send work abroad to Europe. Having said that, though, that is the one thing that they need to do in order to expand.
So you were on the New York digital mission. How was it for you? Successes?
Key one, and it's always a biggie in our field because they're obviously very difficult to get hold of, NBC Universal, Vice President, very, very keen on a whole bunch of stuff. And I think, you know, certainly as a key point, I think that might be interesting.
What do you think, based on your experiences this week, would be the biggest challenges of moving and having a satellite office in New York?
Ooh, interesting. In the entertainment sector, you know, you're literally working job for job. So it's not as if you're landing a great big retainership deal where you know, okay, for over the next 5 years, I'm going to get $1 million a year from setting up an office in New York. So for us, you know, it has to be, you know, carefully managed that because, you know, you could get one big job and then, you know, you don't sort of work with them again. So I mean, in the entertainment sector, it's more fickle. So you'd have to have very much more established deals with the US firms to make that worthwhile.
That was David Jacklin and Eva Ross in that report. Now, Jemima, can you... What I found hard to really... What I was really struggling with when I was in New York and speaking with the British companies and even some of the US companies was really defining what it is that the UK is particularly good at in the web scene. And you're very ensconced in this space. Can you give an overview?
Well, I don't know if there is anything specific. And if you speak to anyone in America, they will always say that the mobile scene in the UK is great. And there are companies like Rumble doing really exciting things there. In terms of what we're really good at, I think we do have a reputation as being very creative and doing things that are slightly more innovative, I think, which is good. But we're constantly trying to define ourselves in comparison to America, and that's not always a good thing. I mean, it's great that we were getting the attention and going out there, and this was in association with UKTI as well. But why did we feel the need that we had to go to America to do that?
To wave the flag. I mean, actually, Charles, this brings up a good point. Do you think that the government is the best organization to be involved with this, or do you think this should come out of a grassroots organization?
I've got to say, I've always been skeptical about quite what role the government can play in technology. I mean, I always feel that its role is to make sure that the conditions on the ground are right, in terms of, you know, encouraging innovation through sort of just taxation things and making sure that, for example, communications providers have, you know, good broadband so that people can take advantage of it. But the sort of the idea of government picking champions and trying to sort of force things always seems to me a bit like a gardener trying to pull plants up out of the ground, say, go, grow bigger, and that's actually the way you just uproot them, and that you just have to let things sort of grow at the pace that they want to grow.
But there is also an argument to say that because it has these networks, it has these connections, you can take people over, or you can introduce people to a broader, fertilized ground extend the gardener.
Actually,
analogy.
I was at Seed Camp briefly
analogies.
Last week. Yeah, just for more gardening analogies. And it's an incredibly supportive environment. And yes, it is competitive because these are companies that are all ultimately pitching to venture capitalists. But if you look at the comments from everyone that was there, who'd been there the whole week, it wasn't like that kind of cliche Dragon's Den thing. It was incredibly relaxed and really supportive, and everyone was so positive. That's the kind of environment that the government should be fostering, isn't it? It was kind of funny that this was a commercial environment, because it didn't feel like that. It felt almost more like a sort of university environment or something. They were saying it's amazing, these mentors, and we feel so inspired, and yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic environment, but not one that the government was involved with noticeably. There was nobody there.
I mean, I think the thing with stuff like Seed Camp, where they're, you know, they are commercial ventures, and one looks at people mentoring, the thing is, for the mentors, there's something in it for them as well. You know, if a company succeeds and they're involved with it, they might get some advantage out of being associated with the company. Whereas if the government is sort of mentoring and things like this, then I sort of feel that, you know, the government, within government, there isn't quite the same discipline about, you know, really focusing on what results are, because government's role is so much wider That there are always distractions, there's always something else to be considered, whereas, you know, a small company just has a very clear idea, which is, you know, basically get to the end of the money with get to the end of the month with more money than you started with and more customers. And, you know, that's a nice, simple focus. It's not like trying to run a government. And I think that's the sort of problem that you come up with when you have a sort of government-private company interface, is that the government's got a much wider remit, basically, and it's so hard to have the right focus.
It was interesting, actually, talking with some of the people about this notion of an incubator culture. Some of the people who were on the digital mission said that they went to San Francisco and they learned in a week more than they'd learned in 8 years of business in the UK. And how can we actually foster that kind of incubator culture in the UK? Is it that we don't have enough VCs over here? Is it that people expatriate over to San Francisco or to the other hubs of digital media? How can we create that fertile ground?
The VC issue is one that always comes up, you know, for as long as I've been in journalism, which is a long time. People have been saying, you know, we just don't quite have as many VCs as they do in America. That's true. And that's just part of how the landscape is. But it doesn't mean that we can't have successful companies from the UK. I mean, you know, look at a company like Autonomy, which is, you know, doing very well. But it actually had to almost pretend to be an American company when it went out to California in order to be successful in the States. So to some extent, you need to have a bit of a sort of split personality and, you know, pretend to be one thing in one country and another thing in another country, and you can succeed.
And also, another important point is that there's a very strong trend for sort of social entrepreneurship, which taps into what we were talking about last week, or rather the week before, with Ewan McIntosh from Channel 4's 4IP project. And those kind of projects are non-commercial and they're not designed to make money, and yet we're really good at these kind of more socially valuable ideas. And that's an ecosystem that VCs aren't likely to be involved in, but, you know, they don't have to be.
Well, thank you both very much for that. And you can hear more about the companies featured and also hear more of those interviews. One of the people who talked was a man named Ramsey, and we're going to be following up with Ramsey later on in the year to find out just whether the UKTI and Chinwag's digital mission had any effect. But now, here's Jemima with the news.
Google has made its long-awaited debut in the mobile market with US partner T-Mobile, launching the first device that runs its Android operating system. Made by HTC, the G1 presents a direct challenge to Apple's iPhone and Nokia, the world's largest mobile phone maker. The FBI searched the apartment of a student in Tennessee suspected of hacking the email of Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. 20-year-old David Kernell is the son of Democratic Tennessee Representative Mike Kernell. Cisco bought the instant messaging firm Jabber for an undisclosed sum, planning to use the technology for both business and consumer services. SanDisk rolled out the new microSD memory card for music to be sold at Walmart and Best Buy in the US. The first batch will include 29 MP3 format albums for around $15 each and will be compatible with most newer MP3 players and phones, but not, of course, iPods.
Charles, does Google have a chance in the telephone space?
I think it does. I think that with T-Mobile behind it, with HTC making the phones, you've got two big names. HTC, not many people would have heard of HTC a couple of years ago.
Well, they're sort of white label, aren't they?
They are. Well, yeah, they are. But actually, now they're stop being white label and their own label. They're making a bit of a noise. And I think that the fact that it's Google, the fact that T-Mobile is behind it, and HTC, who are actually making stuff that other people use already, I think it's very interesting. And I think that the development of Android is going to be really interesting. I mean, I have to say, I was not tempted by the iPhone as much as anything because of the price plans. But I think that when we start to see the pricing on the Android phones, that I think that's going to start to push down the prices of these sorts of data phones. And I think it's going to be very interesting in terms of getting internet devices into people's hands.
Well, this is my favourite point on the Android thing, is that it's going to bring a level of familiarity to the web on mobile phones that's going to be hugely significant in encouraging people to use the internet, because it's been very fiddly until now, unless you had an iPhone. You know, you had to use a WAP browser, you know, that terminology immediately sort of alienates a
chills,
huge number.
Chills
of,
up and chills down my spine.
And so you're going to have a very recognisable Google interface with Gmail and things. It's going to be hugely significant.
But at the same time, I've used some of T-Mobile's previous attempts at web phones, and I found it actually quite difficult. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago when I asked about the possibility of using it, for example, to blog or to open up various browsers. Is this going to be an integrated system wherein it will make it as easy to browse the web? It will actually bring the wonder of the web into the hands of people, or is it going to be yet another clunky attempt at bringing stuff into people's hands and it's actually limited by the technology that it lies on?
Well, given that Google owns Blogger, I'd expect them to come up with a very good interface for blogging on your mobile, because it's absolutely in their interest to encourage people to use the mobile internet for whatever application as much as possible, because the more you use the internet, the more advertising you're going to get, and that's what Google are all about.
We should have a hands-on from Richard Reyes, our telecoms writer, next week.
Yes, nicely plugged. Thank you very much. I forgot all about that. Sorry, Richard. I also want to touch on the incident that happened in the States as well with Sarah Palin's email. Awkward, shall we say, that it was a Tennessee senator's son.
Well,
he allegedly
hacked into her email, or rather logged in using publicly accessible data like her date of birth, you know, bloody blah.
Name of her and first five sons.
He went on to a website whose name escapes me now and said, "Oh, look, I can log in." He changed her password to popcorn. Other people logged in then. The downloading of emails and stuff started. So
and
he was just
the, and
one
the photo,
part of a chain.
This is actually something that I have a problem with, is, you know, besides all the political issues that have spun out of this, but the fact that there were screenshots that were then circulated around the web, which included people's private email addresses that weren't Sarah Palin's. It was everybody else's email addresses that were involved and their private information that then spread around the net. So that's where I would... That's where I would draw the line.
Well, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, the political issue was that she was conducting state business on a private email address, and therefore that couldn't be subject to state regulation, which it has to be under the law. So that was the political bit.
Yes.
Which is a huge thing and something you can't really overlook, and that's why, you know, people felt that they had a right to scrutinise what was going on.
But your daughter's email, you know...
To be honest, though, I think the issue of, you know, whether people in state office should behave by the rules of that office is... I think in some ways that almost trumps it. You know, I think that if this guy was smart enough, if the alleged hacker is smart enough, he could say, well, this is a legitimate piece of journalistic, you know, inquiry. And, you know, there might almost be a get out of jail, if not free, with a slightly reduced sentence.
Notice his dad said in the initial reports, basically said, oh, don't know anything about it. Haven't spoken to him yet. really don't know.
But I'll come and visit.
Yeah.
Well, you can read up on all these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. Here's a few words from a February 2006 article by our own Charles Arthur. You say, Lotus Notes is used by millions of people, but almost all of them seem to hate it. How can a program be so bad yet thrive? Charles, your love affair with IBM's collaborative group software has always been rocky. We've talked about it before in this program. So you managed to track down Ed Brill from IBM to ask years of festering questions. What happened?
Ed is the head of sales for Lotus Notes. So he's the man who's always happy when Notes is mentioned, even if it's mentioned in a disparaging way. Notes is a program which does email, it does calendaring, it'll do collaborative documents of one sort or another. The thing is that the users, the end users, the people who are not involved in any way in setting up, the sort of complaint they have is, well, the email isn't really that good. And they get very frustrated with the email. They find that, for most people, say, if you're using an Apple machine, almost every email program you come across on an Apple machine, if you press the Apple key, the command key, and R, it'll do a reply. Not so on Lotus Notes. This will say, you want to replicate your database. And people go, what the hell is replicate? And what database is that? Similarly with the calendaring, I've noticed, for example, that if I get an invitation for for an internal event sent via the Lotus Notes system, my Apple iCal program, which runs on the open ICS standard, always has adjusted for British summertime, but Lotus Notes hasn't. So I'm always an hour late for the meetings.
So what did you present this list of atrocities to Ed Brill?
Well, the fact is that there are lots of companies which are using Notes, and however frustrating it must be for you know, people who want to do Notes and, you know, send emails and reply to emails even, there have to be people who are finding something useful out of it. So I began by asking Ed, what is it that people don't appreciate about Notes?
Notes was originally designed to be a full collaborative application environment where you could build discussions, help desk systems, contact or Salesforce management. So because it has this sort of blank sheet approach to what do you want your application to look like, Mail happens to be an application we've built for it, but it's not a distinct and unique application within the environment.
Did Notes precede the internet, and that's it, or precede the widespread adoption of the internet?
Yeah, first release was in December of 1989, and we started development in 1984. So we had to build a lot of the plumbing that now exists, but didn't at the time.
With the move to the internet, though, there must be people who are moving out of Notes and basically using all the sort of much simpler online collaborative tools. I mean, I'm thinking of things like, you know, Google Mail, Google Calendars, Backpack, Basecamp, these sorts of, you know, collaborative systems. Yeah. That must be eating into your market share.
It's not, because our market share has tended to be about the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. So the fact that we have an email or an instant messaging or a document library, in and of itself, no one of those is the compelling reason to buy Notes, but it's the fact that they're all tied together. So when somebody looks at a Google Docs, I mean, yeah, we're seeing that being adopted, you know, maybe for a document editing or sharing, and we think, you know, it's great that there are alternatives to Microsoft Office out there. We have one with Lotus Symphony. Sun has Star Office. There's Open Office. All that's good. It's commoditizing that part of the market. But we're not seeing necessarily that it's taking away share from us. I think there's a shakeout to happen still, whether people want rich clients or thin clients or both or neither. And we'll see where that goes.
The reaction one tends to get, or certainly that I come across, whenever I write about Notes or whenever we blog about Notes, and what I discovered was that Notes has a huge group of people who absolutely love it. And they're the people who are building the systems at the back. They're the people who are the administrators. And there's a huge group of people, it seems to me, who really hate it.
Yep.
And they're the people who are using it especially for email, who find the interface clunky, yep, unintuitive, and who simply can't get on with it. How do you reconcile the fact that you have a product that people who are using it just don't get on with, and yet you have a group of people who are looking after it who love it? I mean, that disconnect must create some sort of schism within the company.
It does. It does, absolutely. And it creates ongoing pressure to look at alternatives. When we built Notes version 8, which has been shipping for a year now, we put 6 full-time usability engineers on the project. And the first thing that they did is they went and read lotusnotesucks.4t.com, and they spent a week dissecting it. And they said, you know, how do we go address those complaints? And they did 2,000 usability tests and, you know, basically redesigned the product from top to bottom. So we've been shipping for a year now, and if you talk to customers that are running version 8, which is only about 20% of our base at this point, but they're pretty happy with it. We've seen the opposite effect of the last few years, where people see Notes 8 and they go, oh, I want that, which frankly, I mean, I've been at Lotus 14 years. We haven't had that for a while. And lest you think we thought usability was a one-time effort, that team's now 9 people working on version 9. It is later than we should have done it. Be completely fair and on the record on that. But the complaints that you get today are, you know, admittedly from people who are running back-level versions. And our biggest challenge, and a lot of what, you know, sort of my virtual team around the world is working on, is helping customers upgrade, get to something that's more current.
Why did it take so long to get the usability team focused?
I think, you know, IBM has a tendency to want to build really great engineering and worry about usability later in the cycle. And what we decided to do around 3 or 4 years ago was adopt a user first and a consumability mindset.
Certainly one of the things I found interesting about Notes is that the Domino server, which is the, you know, the server side, yeah, is actually very flexible. And you can, you know, use POP and IMAP on that and it will do the job, and you can choose your email client, yep, at the other end. And I'm almost surprised, given the fact that there are lots of free email clients out there, that lots of companies haven't, you know, found a way around, which is to say, okay, don't use the Notes client, you know, use your own email client for that.
Yeah, most of the companies that run Notes use it for more than mail, 70% of the companies that use it. So if they're going to have a collaborative application, the whole value is I'm in this document and I can put, you know, embedded into this email message a notes document that's part of our contact management system and have the user click once and be in the workflow process. You can't do that through a POP client that's just generic.
Isn't some of the danger in having something that is trying to do all things that it's sort of rather like when you buy one of those hi-fis, you know, the sort of it's the all-in-one hi-fi.
Yep.
And actually the speakers are pretty rubbish and you know, the tuner is not so great and the amplifier's a bit, and the CD player isn't great. Whereas if you go and buy separates,
yep.
you can juice the best and they all link together. If you sort of split it up, you can make it stronger.
I think what we've done to compensate is, you know, try to make everything we do best in class, but also open up both the server and the client to web services so you can bring in anything. It's not about trying to deliver everything as Lotus Notes, but about integrating it with you know, online services or SAP or whatever it may be. So I don't think our attitude is we have to build it all now. And in fact, we're building more modular components across our product line that you can choose to integrate into Notes or you can choose to have somewhere else.
That was Ed Brill from IBM. Charles, what's next for Lotus Notes?
Well, I think that Notes really is under attack, actually, from all the you know, the things that we talked about in the interview, which is all the sort of cloud computing, Gmail, more open ways of doing it, things where you sort of put stuff together. I mean, it was interesting because completely coincidentally, we got an email from Dwayne Orbin, who had seen the article, the February 2006 article that you mentioned at the beginning. And he was talking about how he used to work at a company where they used Microsoft Outlook, which is, of course, the big rival to Notes. And he said, I became the champion of cause, which is getting people not send an attachment to a document that was sent on the LAN drive, just sent a shortcut to the document. So, you know, basically you're sending a link in the email to the document, which meant that he could change the document and that would be reflected when people clicked on the link. And then he moved to a company which used Notes. And he said, I can't do this in Lotus Notes. In Notes, we had to learn about their large document thing, which was within Lotus Notes. Again, in Outlook, it's just a shortcut to a file. Attaching a shortcut to a file is either impossible in Lotus Notes or so unintuitive to do, I haven't even bothered trying to figure it out. Sorry, developers, Lotus Notes still sucks.
So it sounds like there's quite a lot that could be done to make Notes better.
Well, you know, I think, to be honest, you know, I think you just take a flamethrower to it. I mean, Ed's a nice guy. And, you know, he believes passionately in the product. And, Notes 8.5 on the Mac doesn't look awful. But it sort of looked to me a lot like Microsoft Entourage on the Mac, which is a sort of a, you know, great big everything-in-one program where you can manage
it's
projects
like
and email.
It's like stepping back in time. It is like stepping back in time. I'm sure Ed's a really nice guy, but Lotus Notes is just an awful piece of software. It's so unintuitive, it's bloated, it's messy. I don't get it.
So
I've nobbled it so that I can use Apple Mail instead.
What other enterprise solutions then, group collaboration solutions, to use a hackneyed sort of 1999 term, would you use? Would you recommend?
I'm not recommending anything. I just think We could probably use Google.
This is the thing, is that now you can do that. I mean, yeah, to be honest, the Guardian News and Media is now looking at doing, using a Google system.
I believe we are doing more than looking at it.
Shared calendars, shared documents. And when it comes to things like email, well, actually, you can just use IMAP. Because you know the Lotus Domino server, which is the thing that sits the other end, can do POP, it can do IMAP, so it can do those standard mail systems. And the people, if they're using PCs, if they're using Macs, doesn't matter. They can choose. You can use a compliant system.
But wasn't that part of the reason that people? Well, as somebody told me internally, that's part of the reason we used Lotus in house because it's one of the few systems that can bridge between PCs and Macs. Is that right?
Possibly once upon a time it was true, but to be honest,
we just never got around to changing it. Then
it's a matter. Well, that's a gargantuan, giant rolling stone that you'd have to stop and then reinstall and re-teach everybody how to do things again.
Yes, it's sort of like is it better to be running down the wrong side of the hill, or do you actually want to stop and go round the hill?
Dog is for life, not just for Christmas.
Yeah,
not just for
pants to that.
Yes. Pants, well, socks and sweaters.
Well, thank you very much for your insights and thoughts about Lotus Notes. And please do send in your own comments. I know, Charles, that you've frequently blogged about this on technology and have received a lot of commiserations.
And it's always the same. It's always the people who sort of administer Notes and Domino's server and sort of build things for us. It's so good. You just don't understand. It's always the users who say, we do understand. We hate it.
Well, if there is anybody out there who does love it, who uses it all the time, then please do let us know.
Anyone who is an end user. Let us specify.
Yes.
Okay, not a developer, but
absolutely.
who wants to get into the office and go, thank God I'm away from all those damn email clients I was using at home. Last, I'm using Lotus Notes.
No alias
in
email
fact,
addresses.
If you bought your own license for Lotus Notes, do tell us.
Indeed, Charles.
Personal license.
It's going to run them wrong.
Slow down, cowboy. Lotus Notes, do you like it? Please, do let us know. Over in Blogland, the Guardian community has been jumping. Charles, what's been going on in technology land?
Well, people have been fascinated by Sarah Palin and her magical Swiss cheese mailbox.
Swiss cheese mailbox.
Emmental.
It's full of holes.
Oh, right. I see what you meant.
And the best comment, I'm sorry, I didn't get the name of it because of the way the system works. But it was, doesn't the president, you know, given if she was vice president, if John McCain was to have the big heart attack. Doesn't the president have to remember those passcodes for the nukes? I bet she'd set them to ICBM.
She'd set them to popcorn,
yes.
Apparently.
No, because now to set up a bomb, you just need to know the name of her kitten or something.
Yeah. Well, over on the games blog, Keith Stewart, he had a very frank and no punches pulled interview with Microsoft's Peter Moore. And this has rippled its way around the web pretty phenomenally, actually, I have to say. It's been the biggest success thus far of the new blog system. It caused a few sunken ships, not least of which arrived in his inbox and the Guardian's inbox this morning. But this is what Rob Clark had to say about the series. He says, I know this is probably going to sound terribly precious, but I genuinely believe that Peter Moore and people who think like him are toxic to this industry. So clearly he's not pulling any punches either. He says his career is studded with horrible hubris-driven decisions, buzzword-filled pronouncements that paint his current employers as visionaries and his consumers as easily distracted tribalistic children. This all sounds a little bit, this is me talking now, this all sounds a little bit like the football industry, but that's what I know ultimately, isn't it? Anyway, he continues, and you could read more about his Rob Clark's hubris-driven comment over on the blog. But Peter Moore actually sent in his response to the interview, which is also available on the blog, and you can read that there. And this is what Imperfect Rex said about his comment. He says, bearing in mind the length of the interview, the 5 days we got from it, and the fact that no one at EA insisted on seeing it or editing it before publishing, the final few paragraphs are worth having a read. And those paragraphs he refers to are the ones from Peter Moore.
But we wouldn't have let them edit it anyway.
No, certainly not. Well, that's the point of a blog, ultimately, isn't it?
He says... Well, a newspaper, really.
That as well. Microsoft and EA have a reputation for trying to control their press, so it's refreshing that no one is being sued. And I think that's... I do think that's a double points there for Microsoft and EA, even though they did get in touch and said, would you mind publishing this as well? Anyway, Jemima, what's happening on your end?
I did a review of Yahoo's new homepage. And they've introduced a sort of thing where you can customize your homepage with apps, and news is more, well, higher profile type stuff.
Britney falls over steps sort of thing?
Well, actually, The Guardian, it has a branded sort of button tab thing in their new middle column, along with some other newspapers.
15 horoscopes and,
yeah. Well, it's actually quite a tasteful design, I thought. I don't mind it. The thing is, as beautifully pointed out by Mikey the Pikey, basically Yahoo is trying to individualize the content of the Yahoo homepage a la iGoogle, but over 24 months later than Google. Nothing new there then.
Ouch.
He kind of summed it up.
Meow, I know.
Actually, though, credit, I think the new customizable, personalizable Yahoo homepage actually looks nicer than iGoogle.
But why is everyone doing new homepage? You know, Facebook is doing it, yep. Twitter is doing
Twitter
it, Yahoo
did it
is doing
well.
It. What, why?
Everybody's changing.
When I had this,
is it September? New clothes?
Change.
I had this conversation today. Lots of people go to the front page of The Guardian to see what's going on at The Guardian, and then they kind of wander around. I don't think I've ever done that. I just go straight into a site from a link or whatever.
I tend to go to the front page of The Guardian anymore?
I do.
And then I sort of scroll down through the different articles, the different sections.
Really?
I think this is grazing as opposed to hunting.
Well, I do not browse the internet. I hunt.
You're a hunter.
I'm a hunter.
You may be vegetarian, but you're a hunter.
Yes.
With your bow arched
ready to pierce the heart of technology news everywhere.
Well done.
Thank you very much. Anyway.
Let's get that metaphor across the bridge before the thing dies.
That's why you're on a seven-figure salary.
Bring it on. Yes, and I won't bring in the fertilization anymore either. Anyway, you can read more of our dulcet words and our ridiculously contrived sentences on the brand new Spanking Blogs links, which are guardian.co.uk/technology/blog/games or guardian.co.uk/media/PDA. Meanwhile, Chris thinks that the iPhone stand, which we put up on the Flickr pool a couple of weeks ago, looks like a neck scratcher. And therefore, she wins one of her own. Congratulations, Chris. Or shall I call her Alice Taylor? You can get in touch with us any way you can. You can find all the links to us and to all of the communication pathways at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. That's all you get for this week, and thanks very much for listening. Cheers as well to our guinea pigs on the digital mission to New York and to Ed Brill at IBM. Many props to Jemima and Charles and to Scott, our fearless and intrepid producer. Later on this week, we are recording our Newcastle special at the Living Room. Jemima, you've got more details on that, don't you?
Yes, basically we just want anyone and everyone who is interested in Tech Weekly, basically, but just come along and see us and we'll just talk about what you're doing and re-recording a podcast. Yes. So if you just go to upcoming.org and search for Tech Weekly, you will find all the details there. So that's the 25th. So we'll see you there.
And the results of that will be broadcast or podcast in a couple of weeks. However, next week is the music special. So come back to find out from Ian Hogarth and Ben Perot the ways technology has evaporated an entire economic model and how the music industry is adapting to cope with it. In the meantime, I'm Alex Kratowski. See you next Tuesday. We'll